This show is sponsored by you. Stick around until after the news to hear more. This is Cup of Go for Thursday, April 18, 2024. Keep up to date with the happenings in the Go community in about 15 minutes per week. I'm Jonathan Hall.
And I'm Shai Nachman. The energy is all off because it's not a Friday.
It's not Friday. We don't know what we're doing.
Yeah, this is sort of a midweek episode. This feels like a work meeting. Right. So on the agenda today, we have... I'm just kidding. So unlike last week's episode, which was about community and like all this wishy-washy stuff, we're going to jump straight into technical topics. We have a few proposals to discuss, a few deadlines to stress you out with some conferences coming up, and hardcore blog posts from hardcore bloggers. This episode is 100% tech. What's the thing Elon said? Hardcore engineering. This episode is hardcore engineering. But before we jump into all that, we have a really interesting interview today with Paul Jolly talking about Q, the configuration language. So if you're interested in that, stick around till after the news.
Let's kick it off with something super technical. Can you tell me, Shai, what a third-party cookie is and why I should care?
So we're talking about cookies and I'm hungry. This is a bad combination, but I'll try to separate real cookies. Yeah,
I really want some chocolate chips right now.
Yeah, I would kill for a granola bar. But we have first-party cookies and third-party cookies. First-party being from the domain you're visiting. Let's say you're going to cupago.dev. The cookies will be from there. Third-party cookies being from other people, normally ad tech companies, ad servers and like social media sites and pop-ups and comment aggregators and all the non-fun parts of a website that somehow keep the internet alive. The interesting part about a third-party cookie is, you know, when you're visiting our domain, you expect to be tracked across that domain, right? You logged into a service and you want the next time you go to that service that that service will remember you. But if you have a lot of third-party cookies on your site, that means that many people are tracking you. And basically, the main purpose of third-party cookies is to enable adware, right? I'm on a site, I'm doing a thing, I jump to a different site, but the same advertiser is seeing me across these two sites and they can retarget prospective customers. Just if I'm interested in shoes, I'm going to see shoes all over the internet, even in sites I've never visited before that ostensibly should not know me, right? Versus sort of the original purpose of cookies, which was like, oh, I remember you. Your preference is to have the site in dark mode. Or last time you visited this shop, you had these items in your cart. So these are third-party cookies. Would you say you support them, Jonathan?
That's a tricky question. Because, I mean, on the one hand, they're kind of creepy. On the other hand, I would rather see relevant advertisement than irrelevant advertisement, I suppose. And third, there are times that aren't advertising related where third-party cookies can be useful. I'm not thinking of them off the top of my head, but they do exist.
So
I suppose anytime you have an OAuth flow or something like that, where you have a third party managing your single sign-on or something, might be a possible case too.
So Google through Chrome is phasing out third-party cookies, and they have more privacy-preserving solutions. Third-party cookies are not the only way to, once we identify the like cookies that are problematic, you can use different options to migrate to a more privacy-aware solution. One of them is chips. It's a new cookie attribute that's partitioned cookies. That's the focus of the Go proposal we're going to get to in a second, which basically means a developer can opt a cookie into a partitioned storage. So you have like separate cookie jars per top level site. So you could have, you know, the same third party cookie in a different jar if you opt into it. So if I, as the developer of CupaGo, opt into a partitioned cookie, you'll be able to put it in a separate jar in your Chrome. And if two developers opt into the same third-party cookie, it might like work that way. So it's slightly more privacy aware. The site that you're logging into opted in instead of just, you know, use the service. And there are some other options here, which we're not going to get into. Storage access API, related website sets. You can like paint a few different websites as related. And like the whole, you mentioned OAuth. So there's a whole new web API for like identity federation. We just sort of, instead of using a third-party cookie for everything, you know, Google Chrome and their sort of governance board found a few different solutions for slightly more specific problems. And they are phasing out third-party cookies. They're going to be phased out in quarter three of this year. And as part of, you know, they are not doing this out of the goodness of their heart, by the way. The reason they're doing it is to address remaining competition concerns of the UK's Competition and Markets Authority. Basically, the government pointing a finger at Google saying, all right, as the main browser provider in the world, you have to take privacy into consideration. And I assume some fancy lawyers were involved as well. But no lawyers in the proposal we're looking at, which is supporting partition cookies in native HTTP in Go. So with all this, you know, complicated thing about using chips in to put cookies into separate jars where the key is not only the third party site, but also the first party site, you know, you could do it in NetHTTP now. It got accepted. And we're basically adding a new field to the cookie struct, which is called partition.
Wow. I hope I never care about that.
So I hope I never care about it until I develop a third-party adware site. And then I hope it really bums me out. I used to be able to track everyone through every site, and now I have to care about their privacy. What is this? So we really hope, you know, if you're traveling somewhere, that all this cookie talk didn't make you hungry. But, you know, there's a really detailed proposal. The original proposal, by the way, is not very detailed. It's just like, hey, Google's doing this. We need to support it. But there's a lot of comments and like discussing where to put it in the existing implementation. And I think we sort of went with the simplest possible solution. End of the day, the whole background of the problem is complex and interesting, but the implementation is, if the cookie includes the word partition, we're going to add the word partition. Like we're going to make the Boolean value true. So that's partitioned cookies for you, coming soon. By the way, if you do have a site, you should check out Google's, especially like a high traffic consumer site. You should check out the blog post by Google about the new privacy sandbox. We're going to put the link in the show notes. Just in case someone here is a full stack engineer, not just a Go engineer. You know, you need to understand the phase out. You need to audit your use of cookies. And you can even test. They give some automatic tools to test for breakage. So we're going to add that to the show as well, even if it's not strictly Go. That's like the reason this proposal exists.
Let's shift gears a little bit, talk about something else technical. Reflection. This is a fun topic, right? Do you use Reflection very often, Shai?
Yeah, every morning I ask my mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most rejected proposal of them all?
So we have a proposal here from Joe Tsai, who you may recall was on the show a few months ago, talking about the new JSON package is coming up. But I think as part of that work, he's proposed a new function added to the Reflect package called assert2. If you use Reflection very much, you very likely do some manipulation with these Reflect values, and then you call something like .interface, and that returns an empty interface that contains this value. And then you do a type assertion or a type switch on that value to get it back to its core type, a string or a struct of whatever type or whatever. So this proposal relates directly to that use case. And the proposal is to add this assert2 that would replace that .interface call followed by an assertion, and would instead use a type parameter or generics. So you say assert2, and then in the square brackets, you put the type you want to assert2, and then it returns that type containing the data that's in the reflected value. The reason to do this is to avoid a memory allocation, because when you do that reflect dot or the dot interface, you have to allocate that empty interface value that contains the value and, you know, its type. And then you do the assertion and you throw away that thing you just allocated. So this is to reduce allocations for reflection heavy code like the JSON marshaller. So I think it's a really interesting proposal. I'm in favor of it. The only reason I might be not in favor of it is there's another proposal to the compiler team to do some optimizations that might make this not necessary. Maybe the compiler can do this sort of under the hood, so you don't need to do it in the runtime or in the reflection package. But that's a proposal, another technical one for us today.
I really like how Joe just adds a lot of empirical data, showing this is necessary and not just a synthetic sugar. There's a benchmark here based on module proxy data. It's like 500,000 calls to interface, 200,000 of them immediately asserted to a single type. And also, just to be the most fair, suggests a workaround, but the workaround is like gross, but works. One thing I don't understand immediately is when would I need that? Like, I get that Joe is writing like a lot of JSON parsing code and when would he need that? But I can't really understand where would I use it. So it's a case of I have a value and I don't know what type it is. So I want to convert it to a specific type, right? I want to cast it, let's say, to a time.time and get the value back and the like, okay, is it well converted or not, right? That's the use case.
So I've done stuff like this when doing stuff very similar to what a JSON package does, maybe doing validation on structs or setting default values on structs. So I was recently working with a client on a web application where they wanted to set some default values on stuff that was unmarshaled from either JSON or URL parameters or whatever. So to set those default values, I needed to do this exact sort of thing. So it's probably going to be that you're traversing arbitrary data types, structs or maps of stuff and setting values on them.
And I only know the type at runtime. That's why I use reflect and not just casting.
Yeah, or at least you only know some of the type data at runtime. Like you might know that, you know, in this function, I'm dealing with strings, but I don't know how I got to this string value. You know, was it the member of a map? Was it part of a struct field or whatever? You know, so some of the type data isn't known until runtime.
Well, I'll just say that I'm really happy someone did the cookie proposal, but I would rather do the cookie thing than do the reflection code. I don't know if that says good things or bad things on me. I want to mention a proposal that looks similar, but is actually very different. Is. So there was a proposal to add a built-in function called is that looks at a type and basically just lets you do is something of that type. So it's a small wrapper, generic wrapper around, you know, you could be like, is this thing a int? And in the square brackets, you pass the int. And in the regular brackets, you pass the thing. And if the thing is int, it's going to return true. This is something you can do today, right? You do thing dot, and then in normal parens, you put the type, you get the casted value and a Boolean telling you if it casted correctly or not. And you can take a look at that. And the usual way to write it is, you know, how you when you return from a function, you have like the value and then like ERR. In the cast, the normal way you see it is, you know, the type, the value, and then comma, okay. Like, was the casting okay? It's not a built-in. It's just very, very standard. So just wrapping that. And that was rejected. We told you about this proposal a few weeks ago. It was rejected because there are two ways to do it already. And not a lot of people do that. Of localized value, that's at least what you know, the Go team says, and it was declined after, you know, interesting and lively discussion with a lot of data. And, you know, some people liked it, some people, it's actually split right down the middle, 7 upvotes, 7 downvotes, and one person playing Switzerland and you know, abstaining, just added the eyes emoji to, you know, follow the proposal. So, you know, Einer G, thanks for following this proposal. If you missed it, it was rejected. So these are the proposals we wanted to review today. Really interesting ones. I don't know, like very different edges of the language, right?
Mm-hmm. Let's breeze through some conferences and meetups and then end with a few blog posts. So I'll just breeze through these. On the 23rd, that's next week, in both Prague and Rotterdam, we have meetups going on. In Prague, we'll be learning about bubble tea and how to make a better terminal UI. In Rotterdam, I don't know what we'll be learning about because it just says presentations. I was supposed to be speaking at Rotterdam, but I had to cancel because I'm going to Berlin, not Go-related. But if you're in either of those towns, be sure to check those out. If you're not in either of those towns, then a couple of days later on the 25th, we mentioned last week, but we'll mention it again, Conf42 Golang is happening online. You can watch it online. There are a ton of great talks on here. Going serverless with WebAssembly. Talk about testing. There's always more to learn about testing in Go. Go performance. Memory model, profiling, and optimizing your Go apps. There's just, I don't know, a ton of talks on here. April 25th, online. Be sure to check those things out.
One thing I'm going to do right now, and I recommend you do as well, you know, with Conf42, is just like highlight 2 hours on the 25th. It's a Thursday. You know, do like a Golang happy hour at work. I don't know how many people do go at your place. If it's everyone and you're working at a 1,000 people organization, that might be a bit too much. But, you know, bring your closest friends from the guild and just have a watch party. You know, make some popcorn, bring some beers. Even the fact that it's online doesn't mean that you can't, you know, grab an office somewhere at work and like project it on a screen. That could be cool. I'm actually penciling that in right now.
We should do a watch party on our Slack channel.
Ooh, that would be good. Aren't you traveling though?
Yeah.
Maybe. We may do it. We'll let you know.
We might do it. Even if I'm not there, others can do it.
Yeah.
Two other quickies to round out the discussion of conferences and whatnot. A couple CFPs. GopherCon UK is coming up later this year. The CFP is open until May 17. And if you're not in the UK, maybe you're in Italy, GoLab. CFP is open until May 6. So check those out and submit a paper. Even if you've never done it before, please do it.
We want to hear your talks. Everybody has something to contribute. I was just riding a bike from to work today with a friend. And I was really trying to convince her to hand in a paper. We have like a pretty long ride from home to work. It's about 1 hour. And during the span of that hour, while riding on a bike, we came up with two good ideas for talks that I would love to hear. So just take a short walk, think about some ideas if you're even slightly inclined to do that. All these great talks, you know, someone's going to look it up and it's going to be just the answer they need. And it's a lot of fun as well. I can highly recommend it. So let's do some blogs. Did you see the new Microsoft Go blog?
I did. And I learned something from it.
What have you learned?
I learned that Microsoft has their own fork of Go to be FIPS compatible or compliant or whatever. I didn't even know what FIPS was until I looked it up.
What is FIPS?
FIPS is the Federal Information Processing Standards. And FIPS 140-2 is a mandatory standard for the protection of sensitive and valuable data within federal systems.
Oh, it's like FedRAMP approved Go build. That's the thing.
Apparently. So, yeah.
That's interesting. I wouldn't like, you know, federal government and like super suspicious entities want to protect themselves from supply chain attacks, which have been super on the rise recently. This is not news about Go, so we haven't mentioned it, but everybody in tech has been talking about the XZ vulnerability, right?
Yeah.
2 year in the making, somebody's been, you know, masquerading as a contributor and then adding through tests some obfuscated files that allow you to open a shell in the machine. I mean, that's crazy.
Such a weird.
And by the way, it was also discovered by Microsoft. So double shout out. I do have to mention one funny thing, though. There is like a like and comment option and you have to log in to do it. I just want to preface this by saying I'm really happy that there's a new Microsoft for Go devs blog. I really am excited to see more. There's an RSS feed you can, you know, subscribe to. And I definitely intend to do that. But Microsoft being Microsoft, I wanted to like start a comment, to start a discussion, to ask some questions about what they are planning to post about and mention, you know, that we're mentioning it on the show. And if they want to come on the show, whatever. I tried to log in. Microsoft being Microsoft, it failed to log in. Threw me out with an error of try again later.
Unspecified just, error or something like that.
Yeah. Just an unknown error. Try again later. All right. I'll come back tomorrow, dudes. No, don't sweat it. And one last short blog post we want to mention. A really, really good one. And if you're into performance, you probably saw that already. But Ben Hoyt sort of measures Go performance from version to version with benchmarks. The benchmarks are pretty simple. And you can get the entire gist of the blog post by looking at a graph. So I'm going to describe that graph from you. The x-axis is Go versions. So you have a 1.0, 1.1, et cetera, et cetera. And the y-axis is a logarithmic scale going from 0.1 to 100, basically looking at the benchmarks, two super simple benchmarks, and the binary size in megabytes. And the graph basically shows that all the lowest hanging fruits have been picked by like 1.12, and it's been sort of stagnant still, since then. But there have been improvements. With all the low-hanging fruits being picked by 1.12, it's amazing that 10 versions later, which is like 5 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a version every 6 months. PGR improved the performance. You know, it's not 50% because people would have found that, but profile-guided optimizations for the compiler can improve the performance of your thing, whatever it may be. So, you know, Ben here recommends doing it. He compiles the latest Go awk binaries with profile-guided optimization. It makes it faster.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to see that the language is stable in performance. No, I don't want to throw shade, but comparing to Python, which has been trying to improve performance in many, many ways across many different sort of implementation paths over the last few versions, the main use cases have improved, but many other use cases have been worsened. Like if you try to turn on coverage checking or you try to do profiling in Python, you pay huge prices. And in Go, I think, you know, it's a lot more performance aware in general as a backend language. It's good to see that we had a lot of improvements and that we're staying on the right course. The blog post itself, if you want to check out the specific benchmarks and the chart, is in the show notes as well.
Well, I think that wraps us up for the week. Stick around. We have a couple things to share with you over our short break. And then this a wonderful interview with Paul Jolly about Q. Stick around for that.
Welcome to our ad break. We're going to start the interview real soon. Well, we already did it, but you're going to hear it real soon. But we just wanted to mention a few things meta about the show. If you want to reach us, all our links and all our things are at cupogo.dev. That is cupogo.dev. There you could find links to our Slack channel, cupogo with hyphens on the Gopher Slack. You can email us at news@cupogo.dev. You can check out our swag store. You can pick up some cups or some hoodies or some stickers with Brewster, the show's beloved mascot. And you could even find past episodes now with transcripts, which is brand new, and we're happy to have it for people, you know, who want to read what we're saying instead of listen to it. It's kind of a weird way to listen to podcasts, but hey, I'm not going to judge. If you want to more directly support what we do, there are two ways you can do that. First is sharing the show. We don't spend to advertise. The only way we grow is by word of mouth. So if you want to tweet about the show or post about it on LinkedIn or leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or share it with someone from work, there are many, many, many ways you could do that. And we would appreciate it a lot. And if you really like what we do, this is a kind of an expensive hobby, paying for editing, hosting, etc., you can support us directly via Patreon. This is a really good chance to, again, say thank you to all the people who already joined as members to our Patreon. And, you know, it really puts a pep in my step when I tell people I have a podcast and they're like, oh, really? Another white guy with a podcast? and then yeah, but this one people pay to keep alive. And they're like, oh, okay, so it is actually useful. It's not just... Because you have a microphone and this lovely, lovely radiophonic voice, by the way. We want to mention two things. The first one is kind of weird. Beginning of this week, Jonathan, you probably saw it in the news. Israel was attacked by Iran with drones and missiles. I don't know, actually, did it make like headlines wherever you consume non-Go news?
Yeah.
It was kind of a big thing. And totally unrelated, I was just scrolling through our analytics page and I saw we have listeners from Iran. So I just want to say, yo, dudes and dudettes, I appreciate you. No, the learning about tech is bigger than any other, and learning in general and, you know, sharing is bigger than all this political bullshit. And if you listen to the show and you're from Iran, hey, thanks for listening. Other countries as well, right? I'm not singling.
All countries are welcome.
Yes. There are no borders in Go other than the ends of slices. That's what I'm trying to say. And in a more programming e-note, next week is Passover and Jonathan is also traveling. So we're taking 1 week break. You're going to remain cup of Go-less for 1 week, but we'll be back on May 2nd, bringing everything we missed.
May 3rd, I think.
Right to your ears. Thanks for listening. Stick around for the interview with Paul Jolly and we'll see y'all next week. Wait, no, we won't. This is so automatic. We'll see y'all in 2 weeks. That's what I meant to say. Bye.
See ya. See you then.
Jonathan, are you ready to start the interview? Paul, you're all good?
I'm totally ready.
All right, Paul, can you give us a cue?
Well, I'll just wave my hand if that's a good enough cue to get started, right?
Well, you have another cue you want to talk about today. So let's get talking about that kind of cue. No, it's not that kind of cue. It's that kind of cue. This is an audio show, so they're both a Q-U-E. But I always thought it was Q, the letter. And I'm afraid to say English is my second language, so it's an okay...
It feels like a second language to me a lot of the time, if that's any help. And I'm meant to be a native speaker. But yeah, no, there's Q as in QCon, Q as in C-U-E, as in DJ, queue up the next track or whatever. Q as in let me go and join a British queue of people waiting for something or other. All of them.
Yeah. There's QAnon, there's Q from Star Trek, there's all these Qs, yeah. So, Paul, you're both work on Q and you're a Go developer. Where do you get the better puns, with related to Go or related to Q?
Oh, easily Q.
Yeah, yeah.
Easily Q. There's just so many of them on the Q side.
Well, I hope we'll find many of them today, but let's do it proper. Hi, everybody. Meet Paul. Paul, how about you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Paul. I actually started working with Go back in around 2014. And over all the years since then, I've contributed to the Go open source project in various ways. I've mainly been interested in the tooling side of Go, and that really started when the tooling team started building out Go Please, which is the language server protocol, the LSP implementation that I'm assuming almost everybody is using these days as part of their editor. So I love Go as a language, but especially the tooling side of things. But back in 2019, I started working on a project called Q, that's C-U-E, and we'll talk a bit more about that in a second. But Q, like Go, is an open source project, but it's slightly different. Its concentration is mainly in the configuration side of things. And so, yeah, I love open source side of things. I love Go as a language and appreciate you inviting me on today.
Awesome. So Q, is that your full-time job at the moment?
It is, yep.
Okay. So let's talk about that. We talked about Q briefly on an episode a few weeks ago when Daniel Marti was on, because he works on Q also. But we intentionally didn't go deep there because I knew we would have you on the show to fill in that gap. So we'll assume that the people listening missed that episode entirely. And let's just start from the beginning. What is Q? Who should care about it?
It's a good question. So let's first of all start by sort of framing it relative to Go, because I'm assuming most of your listeners are actually familiar with Go. So I would refer to Go as a general purpose programming language. Mm-hmm. I can write an imperative program that allows me to get something done. I tell the Go program what it is I want to happen. And now let me talk about a different language, JSON. And JSON is a declarative data language, right? Mm-hmm. I describe the structure of my data. What Q is it's a sort of a weird mix between a number of different languages, but it's a data language, so like JSON in some respects. It's also a schema language, so like declaring types in Go or declaring a schema in JSON schema. And it's sort of everything in between as well. So instead of just writing out all of my data longhand, I can actually neatly specify some data in Q in templates. Mm-hmm. Q also has this sort of wonderful concept where a type in Q, like a type in Go, string, for example, is the same as a value. So if I declare a field to be of type string, that is, I can also declare that same field to have a value of hello world, for example. Mm-hmm. And Q is all about taking those sorts of constraints, as we describe them, on a field or some data and saying, what is all this stuff valid here? So it's a data types, schema, templating, and policy language all at the same time, and plus a whole load of tooling around it. So it's not something that's going to replace Go. It's not something that's actually going to replace JSON either. But it's meant to sort of sit there as a language or an interlingua between all these different data languages, schema languages, general purpose languages, and it really help you glue things together.
It sounds complicated and confusing. Like, it sounds like maybe I want to learn Kubernetes instead. Tell me why I'm wrong.
What's really good is that, so for example, one of the first things I used Q for was to manage GitHub Actions. So instead of writing YAML, which I really struggle with writing YAML, especially when it comes to collaborating with others, mm-hmm. I find the space sensitivity really tricky mm-hmm. for me personally. And I also struggled with something where I couldn't run like a validation or a vet step to say, hey, is my GitHub Actions workflow correct here before mm-hmm. I actually pushed it up? And writing Go, for example, I can write some Go code and I can say Go test, for example, or Go build and know whether I've got any compile errors. And I really wanted the same when it came to declaring my GitHub Actions workflow. And that's what Queue gives me. So I can declare a schema that says, well, this is what, there's already a pre-existing schema for the GitHub Actions workflows. So I could then say, well, let me validate this YAML and check before I push it up to ensure that this GitHub Actions workflow is structurally correct in some way, shape, or form. But you can go one step further than that. You say, well, now I know my YAML is correct. Can I avoid having to write the YAML in the first place? And this is where the sort of the data side of Queue comes in, is it's a much more rich form of writing data than JSON and YAML. You can have references and templating, as I said. So in this situation, what I then did was I was like, oh, hang on, I've got a lot of redundancy in my workflow here and actually have multiple workflows in the same repository. So I just took the common bits of those workflows and said, well, hang on, let me lift out the common bits here and then just template them in and then validate that all of these workflows are correct and then spit out some YAML and push the YAML up to GitHub Actions. Mm-hmm. So I can then maintain my configuration for GitHub Actions in a much more maintainable way there. I can run tests on it, I can validate it, et cetera, and then have confidence when I push that, there we go, I'm safe. I know this is actually a valid workflow. It may still fail at runtime, but that's sort of true because of the runtime nature of GitHub Actions.
Yeah.
So for me, it's actually a massive simplifying step, is that I can use a much more, I don't know, principled is quite a strong word, but when we think of adding type safety to things, that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to add a bit more rigor to my mind to things. And so that especially if you're working as a team, you can just have confidence that, hey, Jonathan, I've made a change to the GitHub Actions workflow. I'm confident that it's structurally correct because it passed these tests. It passed sort of the type check. Over to you now. And we can do that. And especially when you're working as a team, you don't want to just be pushing off a YAML file with sort of no confidence really that it's actually working. So yes, I think there's the nice thing about Queue is you can start very, very small by just validating some existing JSON or YAML files. And a lot of companies actually do that. They say, hey, we've just got some JSON that really we don't know how to trust it. Mm-hmm. And so they start by incrementally adding rules that constrain the JSON and they check, does this JSON satisfy these rules? And then they build it up and they gain confidence in that. And so at that point, they've created themselves a schema that describes the data and they can quick check in that. So then they said, well, we know this data satisfies that schema. What can we do with that schema? Well, maybe you can then sort of start to establish contracts between different parts of the system to really build up your level of confidence with things. So it sounds very scary, but at the same time, you can start very, very small. And as users and companies tell us, they start small and then they sort of find that Queue finds its way into lots of different parts of the system. As I said, they start to build up these stronger relationships between different parts of their system. Mm-hmm. So that's really the thinking behind it, is that you can incrementally build up your confidence and maintainability of your data, your schema, and systems, cool. Including things like policy as well.
Yeah. So you mentioned GitHub Actions as a good example, and you said that there is a schema to validate that. Was that something that had to be created by the Queue group, or was it like, was there already an existing schema that you could use to validate that?
That's a very good question. There is actually an existing schema. And it's written in JSON schema.
That was my second question, yeah.
Yeah, so you might think to yourself, hang on a second, that's a bit odd. So when I talked earlier on about the fact that Queue can speak all these different languages, we refer to those as different encodings. Mm-hmm. So if I write some data in Queue, I can emit that as JSON data. And we all know what JSON will look like. I could choose to emit it as YAML. But Queue can import and export these data formats. And it can do the same with schema formats as well. So if someone's gone to the trouble of writing out a JSON schema to describe the shape of some data, in this case, a GitHub Actions workflow, Queue can natively understand that JSON schema and say, let me import it. And you can generate a Queue schema or a Queue definition in that case from the JSON schema. Mm-hmm. And then use that result. Either you can continue to have the JSON schema as, if you like, your source of truth, or you can say, well, hang on, thanks for the JSON schema. I'm going to now maintain the Queue definition now. And make that the source of truth and use that for all my validation. So no, in this situation, we actually still use the GitHub Actions JSON schema that is published on schemastore.org. Mm-hmm. Very interestingly, for some reason, GitHub don't maintain, and they have said, they have confirmed publicly that they don't maintain a schema for a GitHub Actions workflow.
Okay.
Which to my mind is interesting.
Yeah.
Because of course, I think it makes sort of everybody else's lives a bit tricky because they have to rely on what's in documentation. But the folks who are behind contributing to schemastore.org have done it for the GitHub Actions workflow and many others. And those people who use Qt can then benefit from it immediately, because you can, as we do with the Qt project itself, we import the JSON schema, the GitHub Actions workflow, mm-hmm. and then we just work natively with the Qt tooling from there. This is the whole point of Qt, is that the sort of world is a bit of a messy place. Mm-hmm. There's lots of different representations for data, schema, and Qt really is trying to meet people where they are with that messiness in understanding, look, you don't have to convert everything to Qt day one. You can keep the system as being YAML-based. You can use JSON schemas as your source of truth here, or you can continue to define your types and protocol buffers here. And Qt will allow you to sort of glue it all together, as it were.
So what's the advantage in this particular case of using Qt over just some off-the-shelf JSON schema validator?
Yeah, very good. That's a great question. The thing is, when it comes to one of the purposes of Qt is to do data validation. And let's take GitHub Actions again, because it's a very good example. The JSON schema for the GitHub Actions workflow, what it allows you to do is it allows you to take a piece of data in YAML or JSON and say, is that one piece of data valid mm-hmm. according to mm-hmm. that schema? Mm-hmm. So it is a pure data validation thing when it comes to JSON schema. So that's one of the roles that Qt can perform. It can do that data validation thing. But the slightly larger goal there is to try and make your maintenance of configuration and the composing or the writing of configurations simpler and more robust from a Qt perspective. So rather than just taking that one GitHub Actions workflow, it's like, well, that configuration for that workflow exists in a much bigger configuration space. And Qt as a language allows me to describe how my configuration space, how that larger configuration is built up. And if you imagine that you're sort of at even a small company, you've got different systems and each has a configuration. You can sort of, if you squint a bit hard, you can sort of imagine each of those separate configuration silos, if you like, as being part of one configuration space. And mm-hmm. Qt is the language that actually allows you to define that single configuration space and then ensure that you've got consistency between different parts of your configuration. So that means that that GitHub Actions workflow doesn't just exist in isolation. It possibly even has values in it that are derived from somewhere else mm-hmm. within our company configuration. Mm-hmm. And I can express that in Qt. And once I've expressed it, I then have that consistency between those different parts of the system as well.
And I think, at least from scrolling through the documentation and sort of looking at it, it looks a lot friendlier than writing JSON schema. Writing JSON schema by hand, at least for me, like super difficult.
Yeah, I can't say that it was like an explicit goal to be easier than JSON schema. I think it's one of those situations where JSON schema has existed for some time and continues to serve some situations incredibly well. So it's absolutely not a situation where we're going to say, oh, we're trying to replace JSON or YAML or JSON schema, right? Is that there's lots of systems that are based in these different representations. But yes, I tend to agree with you, Shai. It's a much more succinct, shorter form that is much easier to maintain. And I think for us, what we've seen, even with, for example, managing the Qt project's GitHub Actions workflows, which is quite a small scale thing, but it just, you get small benefits in even small situations like that, especially when you're working as a team. You can describe your configuration much more succinctly as well, not just the validation part of it too.
What I'm imagining from, at least from walking through the documentation, is there are many, talked about glue a lot, and it looks like it does. I can come into any place and be like, okay, so I see, for example, you have your configuration or your, API messages, and your entire API defined in protocol buffers. So it wouldn't be too difficult for you to also define your configuration in a protobuf, and then I can extract Qt from it, write the configuration in Qt and sort of have a great time. You can use protobuf to generate for all the languages you're using. And even if Qt doesn't directly support Scala today, of course, you're already compiling it from protobuf, so no problem. And it looks like it sort of connects really well. What I'm interested in is, what was the integration process like? Because this is not just a like hobby project, that you're using on like some open source thing. On the homepage, there's Salesforce. Like every startup would have that logo on their homepage, you know what I mean? Yep. So I'm wondering what the integration process was like in a real case, I'm not talking about just technically, but when humans were actually involved and you sort of like You know, you probably have someone on the company who's really excited about Q because they really like Go, or they played a lot with schema definitions before and they find the appeal. How was their pitch and what sort of roadblocks did they face when they tried to introduce this into the tech stack?
Fascinating question. I sort of alluded to this a bit earlier on, is that the nice thing about Q is that you don't need to replace something day one. You can just say, here is our system right now. This data is based in JSON. Let's understand this data a bit more and start to build things up from there. And that is honestly the story that we hear time and time again from different users of Q, whether they be users are sort of who are themselves maintaining open source projects or users in large companies as well. So the data validation is a very common one, very messy situation of, you know, we don't understand the shape of this data, or we would like to add some guardrails, for want of a better phrase, to ensure we understand the shape of this data. And then it starts to go from there. Is if you can quickly prove to people some value from something as simple as data validation, that can actually provide some serious leverage. We say, well, we can now trust that the data in this part of the system here satisfies this schema. You say, well, oh, great. Okay, well, now let's take that schema. And Shai, just as you were saying, let's co-generate from that schema to some other language now. And we can then start to ensure that we have consistency between different parts of our system. And so that's exactly how people who are picking up Q are using it. They're finding, hang on a second, we get all these nice wins in lots of separate places, perhaps, within the company. And there are a number of situations where there are different people at the same company who are each using Q without being aware of other people within the company using it. And then the nice part of Q is that this compositional side of it is you can take those two people working independently and they can just seamlessly combine their efforts if they want to start looking at things through one lens, through sort of one view of configuration. And things can continue to work in exactly the same way as before. And this is a very intentional part of the design of Q, this compositional side of things, is that you've just got to describe the shape of how you're working together. But it's absolutely the intention that it doesn't matter how many people are working together, how they coordinate, is that you just chuck all the configuration into one bag, as it were, and then say, does this validate? And then your tooling can hang off that. So whether it be, as you said, Shai, co-generating to protocol buffers or something off the back of it, it's all then coming from effectively one source of truth. And so Q sort of spreads a bit through different projects and organizations in a very natural way, because it's allowing you to increase your confidence throughout a system and therefore make changes more confidently. And so that's one of the positives. I think one of the, to sort of address one of the questions that you raised there, Shai, of what are some of the challenges with it? I think when it comes to a new language and a new approach to things, that's obviously where there are going to be challenges. And Q is quite different to, at least as far as I'm aware, all sorts of languages like it in the way that it works in this compositional side of things. And so as such, you need to think in a slightly different way with Q. And so, yes, there is a learning curve there, and arguably a steeper learning curve than YAML versus JSON, for example. They're very, very similar in their form there. So once you get over that learning curve, and we're working on tooling to make that and documentation to make that an easier process, the benefits that people have reported back to us saying, once we got over this learning curve, and there are some companies who actually have internal training on Q, for example, such that their platform teams are actually building out internal training to help others within the company, the benefits that people get from maintaining things with Q are what we hear as being sort of the gold at the end of the rainbow, as it were.
Let's talk a little bit about the history and future of Q. How long has this project been around? Where did it come from? Just briefly, of course, we don't have time to go into years of history, but, you know, kind of where did this project grow out of?
And if you want it, you can just like Git log, right? For some reason, I feel like the commit history on a project that's so meta, that's only about configuration, is pretty good.
Yeah. So Q was created by somebody else that I work with called Marcel van Lohausen. Mm-hmm. Marcel worked at Google for, I think it was nearly 20 years. So a long time Googler. And when throughout Marcel's time at Google, he had sort of his main focus was on things like things that were configuration based. So he also worked on the predecessor to Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was Borg is the name of it, as well as a couple of in-house Google only configuration languages, BCL and GCL. And we sort of see open source manifestations of those in the form of things like JSONnet. So Marcel was, I think, I don't want to sort of misquote him here, but I'll paraphrase. He was unhappy with a lot of the decisions that had been made over the years as far as configuration language design at Google was concerned. And the last 10 years of his tenure at Google was spent working on the Go team. So he worked very closely with the likes of Rob Pike, Russ Cox. And I think you can sort of see a lot of Go influence in Q as well. It was around the end of 2018, I think, that the first commit that Marcel made for Q whilst he was still on the Go team. Mm-hmm. He started it as an open source project, and it remains an open source project to this day. And Marcel, I probably best describes it as being Q is fixing all the things that he got wrong in other configuration languages.
All right.
And really, that doesn't just, it's not just the language itself, but it's also, well, because a language doesn't exist in isolation. There's all the tooling that you build on top of that and the ecosystem that sort of builds from there.
Right.
And so really that's how and why Q grew as it did. And then I think it was around the middle of 2021, Marcel decided to leave Google, and we've been working on Q full-time since then.
Very cool. I had the pleasure of meeting Marcel actually at my first ever Go Amsterdam meetup when I first moved here. And I've met him once or twice since then. He's been to a couple, and he spoke about Q. That's where I first heard of Q. Was shortly after he launched the project, he spoke about it at the Go Amsterdam meetup. So,
well, I think you may even have heard about Q before I did then, Jonathan.
Maybe so. I don't know.
I think you did. I think it was in London that in 2019 where Marcel said, oh, because I think Marcel and I first met when I gave a talk at GopherCon London, I think it was, or whatever it was called before GopherCon London, back in 2017. And he came up and introduced himself afterwards. And then in 2019, he said, hey, I've been working on this thing you might be interested in. And yeah, sort of all started there, as it were.
Nice. So that's the history. What's coming up? What exciting things are on the horizon for Q?
A sort of key part to Q is actually the core evaluator. That's the, if you like, the logic that sits at the heart of everything. Marcel is the brains behind the core evaluator, and he's working hard on a much more performant version of the core evaluator. So what we should see is some significant improvements in performance Q-wise, and that's a really important thing that Q users have been reporting to us. QLang.org, that's C-U-E-Lang.org. We've just released a new version of the homepage, which has got hopefully vastly improved documentation, examples.
Yeah, I was just about to say, the website is, you knocked it out of the park. When you first wanted to schedule this interview, this is a little bit like behind the curtain here. But you had the old homepage, and now that we have the new one, I can say, and you won't be insulted, the old one sucked. The new one is really, really, really good. I love the playground. Any language that lets me play around with, and this is, if you're listening, it's sort of similar to the Go Tour or, JSONATA playground or things like that, where you have rich examples and you have a lot of explanations and you can just play and run, and it really helps directly in the browser and you don't have to install anything.
Yeah.
For me, even though your tours and your tutorials and your reference documentation, and it's all good, it also looks familiar. Like if you're coming from Go, I think you'll feel right at home. The playground for me is just such a strong selling point where I can just tell someone, hey, look, this is how it works, and just send them a link, and it just works. What sold me on JSONATA in the past, and I've used JSONATA extensively in the other project. What sold me on Rego for like policy validation that we use here where I work at Orca, and it was the main turnoff when I've been trying to convince people to use protocol buffers, because you have to do so many things to just get started to even, it's so far removed from a playground. It's just amazing. So super good job on the site. Even if you're not planning to use Q, I think you should check out the website just since it's so, technical documentation that's written really well. I think it's a really good example.
That's very kind. Thank you for the feedback. I'll just a brief tangent, if you'll allow me, Jonathan.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started working on Q, the playground was a weekend hack project for me.
Okay.
Where over a couple of days over the weekend, Go had recently just, I think it was quite recently at the time, just added support for compiling to WebAssembly. And I thought to myself, feels like there's something doable here. So over the course of the weekend, I built the Q playground, the first version of it, which was very, very basic, because that's exactly what you get when you land on the Q playground. It downloads a blob of WASM and then runs everything within your browser. So Shai, the idea is that we will absolutely build out the playground to support those different sorts of modes. Interesting that you pick up Rego as an example there. One of the modes that we want to allow is people writing policy, where they write a policy in Queue, provide some data, for example, a payload that they want to check. Does it satisfy this policy and then get an answer? Or perhaps just validating some JSON, a pane for some JSON, pane for the Queue schema. Does this validate? Yes or no? And then these sort of be, as you said, things that you can say, hey, I just hacked this together. I still share so many examples through the Queue Playground because it's so easy to do. So yeah, the Queue Playground's a really valuable part of the site. As you mentioned, there's lots of new docs there. One of the other things we've been working on is modules. So for anyone who's familiar with Go modules, Queue needs a sort of a means of package management as well. And we have an implementation of modules that's out there right now. We're just getting close to being able to accept that proposal, which is nice. And we're working on an implementation of a central registry for Queue modules so that if you have, let's go back to our GitHub Actions workflow example. Let's just say I want to start using Queue to write my GitHub Actions workflows. Rather than having to import the JSON schema, I should just be able to say, hey, use the Queue definition or the Queue schema that is at this within this module, and let me just start writing. So the central registry is intended to be a well-known place for well-known schemas, for well-known software, so that you can just start writing and say, hey, I just want to write. So idea being that in 3 or 4 clicks, effectively, you can be up and running with a GitHub Actions workflow or a Kubernetes configuration, for example. We're also working on different encoders. So that's Queue's ability to speak different languages. So as I said, it speaks JSON and YAML as data languages. TOML is one that we're going to be adding, and other data languages as well. Looking to go improve our JSON schema support, open API support, so being able to import, export from these things as well. Going beyond protocol buffers, go to other general purpose languages as well. For example, the ability to generate TypeScript would be nice. So if I describe a validation in Queue, for example, would be really nice if I could just generate some TypeScript where that validation happens in the front end without having to sort of round trip to the back end. Again, that whole idea of a single source of truth for things. The ability to evaluate Queue from different languages. We haven't talked about this, but I can write a Go program that then natively uses some Queue to perform some validation of some data, some payload. We should be able to do the same from Java, Python, other languages as well. And this is what different projects and companies are asking for, that ability to use Queue in these different settings rather than just as a command line tool or just from the Go API to span out to different languages as well. So yes, there's a number of things we're working on. It's a fun time to be working on Queue at the moment. And we've got a number of people who are very graciously joining us and contributing from an open source perspective as well. So it's a fun time.
Well, I want to encourage listeners to try Queue. I'm going to try Queue to validate my GitHub Actions, I think. Sounds like a nice, easy place to start.
When talking about that, how easy it is to integrate Queue in my CI? Because I assume the place where it's most useful is where I added some configuration that's stored as code. And then the CI catches it, or I try to deploy some new configuration from something and then some automated process catches it. I think you don't have to be a Go shop to introduce Queue into that pipeline, right? It's just like install Queue, Queue vet, and you're done, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So setup Queue is a GitHub action. Let's continue with the GitHub Actions theme here.
Although even if you use a different CI provider, it's not going to be like checking environment variables if you have GitHub underscore run. And if it doesn't have GitHub underscore run, it's like, fuck you, we don't support GitLab. Get the shit out of here.
Yes. Other systems exist, not just GitHub. So yes, GitHub, for GitHub Actions, we have setup Queue, which is an action that you can trivially add to your workflow that will install the Queue command line. And you sort of got to, if you think of the Queue command line as like a Swiss Army knife of tools that you can do various things with. So for example, Queue vet, export, etc. Shai, as you said, you absolutely don't need to have, and for a number of our workflows, we don't install Go at all. We just install Queue. And then we do everything with the Queue command line. It does some regeneration for us. We have some workflows that are written in Queue as well. And then, yeah, so for example, a Queue vet will make sure, does this data satisfy this schema? And then generally speaking, what we do at the end, especially if we're generating things with Queue, is we just check, is this commit clean at the end of the workflow? And that's a really useful check to make sure we've run all these checks, regeneration steps. Now, is the commit clean, as in there aren't any changed files, etc.? And then you can really increase the robustness of your workflows that way around, because you know you've got reproducibility, and really that's sort of the name of the game when it comes to Qt.
Cool. We will have links to the website, although it's easy to find, qlang.org.
Although not Q, the letter
yeah. Q.
C-U-E. It's Q-Lang. C-U-E. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's links to the Slack, the community Slack that we have there, which is extremely popular. There's a number of discussions that happen via GitHub discussions as well in the main Q repo. But yeah, if anyone's, everyone's welcome, the Q Slack. Lots of fun chats over there.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I have to say the conversation on the Q Slack is very interesting. Like when we first scheduled the interview, I joined the Slack community, and I just scrolled through, you know, some conversations, and it made me realize how deep this project actually is. You know, when people are talking about, so I'm validating so many files, so I'm running into performance limitations of I'm struggling on that case and on this case, and people asking for the extreme edge cases. You understand just from sort of the level of conversation in the room that this project is very mature. Even though in our sort of talk here, you mentioned a lot how easy it is to get into, it is also very, very deep. Like, I do believe that if you started from day one, if I started from day one right now, a new company, and I had to decide on all the tech, so I do believe I would go with protobufs, for example, for API definitions. But perhaps instead of using PGV, I would use Q for the validation and generate the PGV code from it. Or maybe I would use Q full stop and like from Q generate protobuf, from protobuf generate OpenAPI, from OpenAPI generate the front end code. Like, or maybe directly from Q. But it looks like something that could totally be foundational at this point. It doesn't have to be like just a nice script on the end. I'm wondering if someone really implemented it like, you know, the whole way through, and when the developer joins the company, they have 2 days where they have to learn Q top to bottom because they're a Q, you know, shop. Is there a place that works like that?
So it's very interesting is that somebody we spoke to said, basically the way they hold Q in their head is they want Q to be a second language for everybody within the company. As in, doesn't matter what your sort of first general purpose programming language is, whether it be Go, TypeScript, Java, whatever. Q, as I've sort of said repeatedly, is this glue between different languages and representations of things, is really something that struck a chord with them. So they really, Shai, they do sort of, I think that really chimes with what you just said there of, you've got this sort of messy situation of people working with different situations between companies, etc. And as a glue, that's how they see Q there. But it's really interesting that you describe Q as being very deep. I think one of the challenges that we see is Q is extremely broad as well. It's not specific to, say, Kubernetes or GitHub Actions or policy. It can, for better and for worse, do all of these things. And the thing is, you can then combine all these different parts of your project configuration together with Q and do so in a way where you can have confidence that it's all correct. But I think that's one of the challenges as well. And the fun challenges of that when it comes to people learning Q is they're like, wow, it can do so many things. Where do I start? And that's where we encourage people towards that. Hey, let's just start with some JSON validation, or even better, tell me what you do on a daily basis. And then think about how we can sort of apply Q in that situation. So whenever I'm speaking to folks who are trying to say, well, hey, I've heard about this Q thing, I actually turn the question around and say, tell me, what do you do on a daily basis? And I then think about, well, what ways can Q actually help you get things done better individually and then better as a team collaborating together? And so that's what I think is one of the main fun challenges in front of us, is how to sort of present people with those really compelling examples of how it can help give them wins and then give their team and company, project, whatever it might be, wins as well.
So let me take that one step further. It can be used for everything. I assume someone tried to misuse it. It's like Q is not Turing complete, right? I can't accidentally write my entire programming logic in the validation, you know, in the little brackets.
Yeah.
It's a pretty funny question because, you know, misuse is a very broad term. I mean, if an army of a nation you don't really like is using a Q to validate their missile systems, it might be okay technically, but you might consider it misuse. I'm talking about just technically, like someone tried to use Q for something that's super schemaless and it ended up backfiring. Like, where would you say, hey, hold on, I'm not sure Q is a good fit here.
It's a really tough question. I think the where it's sort of, if you like, backfired for people right now is where they've tried for now to do too much and they've hit the performance ceiling. So this is why Marcel is working on the core evaluator and performance side of things, because Marcel's background coming from Google, they worked with configurations that I will never conceive of in terms of the size of them, hundreds of millions of lines of configuration. And the idea behind Q is that it should also, it's not just a hobby project. It is something that should also be workable at scale as well. And so this focus on the performance side of things is where people have hundreds of thousands tipping into millions of lines of configuration, and they're trying to use Q to validate this because their logical, their single configuration graph is just growing and growing as they add bits into it. So I can hardly call that misuse of Q because it's doing exactly what Q is intended for. The reason it's not working out for them right now is we're just working on these performance side of things right now. So fundamentally, though, we've had people building network configurations using Q and then using them to validate configuration that is sent to switches, for example. The thing is that it's people driving home automation using Q. There's no sort of right or wrong in this situation. If you have some data, payload, call it what you want, that needs to go between two systems, Q is very good at then acting as that contract language between the two of them. And if you then want to build out the tooling sort of around all of that, great, and you can sort of organically build it from there. So it's a bit of a non-answer, shy, sorry. I couldn't think
of... No, the answer is you can't go wrong. Just use it slowly. That's also super fair.
I think the answer is a challenge to our audience to come up with a way to misuse Q. Please. And report back.
Yeah, yeah.
Introduce Q into bad places in your companies and let us know. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're getting close to the end here. We've talked for quite a while. It's been a good conversation, but we like to ask a standard question at the end. It's not really about Q, more about you and your experience with Go, since this is a Go podcast after all. So the question is, if you can remember far back to when you were first learning Go, what was the biggest challenge or surprise, perhaps, about Go or about the learning process that struck you?
That is a very good question. I started learning Go around 2013, 2014. And I started learning Go when I was applying for a job at a company. And I think I just started learning Go, or yeah, it was very, very close to that time. And one of these, the interview questions that I got asked to prepare for was writing a web crawler. And you could choose whatever language you wanted. And I thought, well, I've heard about this concurrency thing in Go. That sounds absolutely perfect.
Right.
The thing that I found tricky at the time, and I still do to this day, to a certain extent, is thinking about how to structure a program when it comes to concurrency in Go and the parts of a program, the logical parts of a program, and how they should work together concurrently. And so I don't think that's really a challenge with Go per se. It's really just sort of like an engineering problem of, well, how would I structure this thing? And what are the primitives from a Go perspective? What are the building blocks that will allow me to build a solution? And concurrency, concurrency is one of those which my brain doesn't work very well concurrently. So I end up drawing lots of diagrams when it comes to doing anything with concurrency in Go. I love the concurrency patterns in Go. And I think the new work that Russ Cox has been working on with the iterators is fascinating. I honestly, I haven't fully gotten around to absorbing it. Jonathan, I expect you have, but I think that will be I think that'll be another phenomenal part. And maybe that will sort of make things a bit more natural in some situations. But as I said, yeah, I still to this day draw lots of diagrams when it comes to concurrency.
I'll tell you, I'm so far behind the curve. I'm only in the last 3 to 6 months sort of wrapping my head around generics.
Oh, yes. So. Yeah.
It'll probably be another year and a half at least before I start ranging over functions.
Yeah. I think we've only got a light amount of generics in the Q code base. Again, it's sort of where it's the best tool for the job. I think that's one thing I have learned from the Go project a lot is, you know, whether it's the right tool or the right language or the right part of the language is just use the right thing for the right job. And then there's sort of like there's less effort required for anybody else reading your code. It's just like, oh yeah, that's obvious. And that's trying to make things obvious. And Q is very similar in that respect with the 10 years that Marcel spent on the Go project. It's how can we make things easy and obvious for people and therefore more maintainable and readable? That's the focus of things.
Great. Well, let's round out here. If people are interested in Q, of course, qlang.org is a place to go. If people are interested in asking you questions, follow-up questions, are you available on social media? How can they contact you?
Yeah, as I said, the Q Slack is a good place. That's linked off the qlang.org homepage. I'm on Twitter as well, _myitcv. Okay. It's my Twitter handle. But yep, the Q Slack is a great place. And there's lots of, if you turn up in the Q Slack and say, oh, I'm here from CupAgo, you'll be more than welcome.
20% off your first question. Wonderful.
Brilliant.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's been a pleasure. As always, thanks for coming on. Hope to chat with you again before too long.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks ever so much for inviting me on. And thanks to Shai, too.